good evening. The president threatens Iran, Biden, and the war in Iraq. Did he lie? And marijuana on Capitol Hill. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the news for Friday, January 17th, 2020. President Donald Trump has assembled a made-for-TV legal team for his Senate trial. The roster of legal celebrities includes household names like Alan Dershowitz and Ken Starr, the prosecutor whose investigation resulted in the impeachment of Bill Clinton. The two new Trump attorneys are nationally known for their involvement in some of the more consequential legal dramas of recent American history. They are also regulars on Fox News, Trump's favorite television network. Dershowitz, a former Harvard professor, is a constitutional expert whose expansive views of presidential powers echo those of Trump. Starr is a veteran of partisan battles in Washington, having led the investigation into Clinton's affair with a White House intern. The lead roles for Trump's defense are played by White House counsel Pat Cipollone and Trump personal lawyer Jay Sekulow, who also represented Trump during special counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation. Starr was recently removed as president of Baylor University in the wake of a review critical of the university's handling of sexual assault allegations against football players. Dershowitz's reputation has been damaged in recent years by his association with accused predator Jeffrey Epstein. One of Epstein's alleged victims, Virginia Roberts Jeffrey, has accused Dershowitz of participating in her abuse. Dershowitz has denied it. Meanwhile, Trump invited the 2019 college football national champions LSU Tigers to take pictures in the Oval Office today. He took a moment to describe his impeachment in colorful terms as he showed off the Oval Office's historic desk.
The Resolute Desk. It's been there a long time. A lot of presidents. Some good, some not so good. But you got a good one now. Even though they're trying to impeach the son of a bitch. Can you believe that?
And the effect of the ramping up of defense budget items meant to rebuild the nation's arsenal is running into resistance. The National Nuclear Security Administration, part of the Department of Energy, is making plans to sharply increase its capacity for manufacturing the plutonium cores of nuclear weapons, commonly called PITs. The two sites where the triggers for nuclear weapons will be made are Los Alamos, New Mexico, and the Savannah River site in South Carolina. NNSA is responsible for the U.S. nuclear weapons stockpile, from the design efforts at national laboratories like Lawrence Livermore to manufacturing, transportation, maintenance, and security. Pit production has been a challenge for the U.S. since closure of the Cold War manufacturing site, the Rocky Flats plant near Denver in 1989. There have been numerous failures to restart bomb production. The director of Savannah River Site Watch is Tom Clements. He joins us from Columbia, South Carolina.
The government wants to replace all the plutonium cores, or so-called pit. It's a sphere of plutonium in all the U.S. nuclear weapons. They are proposing to do this at the Los Alamos National Lab in New Mexico and also at the Savannah River site here in South Carolina. And that facility would be located in a project that was abandoned last year called the Plutonium Fuel Project, or MOX. And they would do this new plutonium bomb plant inside the MOX plant. Over the years, it would be multi-billion dollars. They would replace all the pits. It's a hollow plutonium sphere that basically causes the nuclear reaction in nuclear weapons.
Have you ever seen a plutonium pit?
Oh, no. This is totally classified. In fact, it's hard to find pictures of them because they don't want you to know the scale, what the size of them is. So there's very little in the way of graphics or diagrams of these things, but they weigh maybe on the order of a couple of kilograms of plutonium, high-quality weapons-grade plutonium.
Are they different have they changed the design over time, like the ones that were used in the early bombs in the 40s and 50s? Are they different from the ones that are used today?
Well, that's the thing. They have over 15,000 of these are stored at DOE's Pantex plant in Texas. And they could reuse a lot of these if nuclear weapons are going to be kept. And those were mostly made at a facility called Rocky Flats, which was near Denver, and the FBI raided it in 1989 after there were several plutonium fires and they were engaged in some illegal activities, and it shut down. So there's been no large-scale pit production since the early 1990s. There is some pit production capacity at Los Alamos, but they've not really been able to do it. So here they are, trying to propose that we're going to produce over 80 of these per year, and they can't even do it at what they call the Plutonium Center of Excellence at Los Alamos. So when the MOX project was shut down here in South Carolina, there was a shortfall for contractors of about $500 million, who Senator Lindsey Graham was protecting the project. So this is basically to throw more money to the Savannah River site for a new mission that they don't need. There's no justification for it, but it is moving through Congress. In the Defense Act in December, there was some money to continue studying for the plutonium bomb plant at Savannah River site, and the DOE is now, the National Nuclear Security Administration, is basically moving full speed ahead with this, but it's a long ways to go.
It'll be a while before they actually start manufacturing them at that number.
They want to produce 30 of these pits at Los Alamos and 50 at Savannah River, 50 or more. We don't know what "or more" means, by 2030. So this would be pouring $1 billion a year down the rat hole. Even if it fails, the contractors would get rich. So we're talking over 10 years from now when they would want to do this, but they're rushing into it so fast, there's really no justification. Congress is allowing them to spend the planning money, and that's definitely going to be revisited this year. But it's a ways off, and just like this MOX project, over $8 billion was wasted on that. There's been no investigations into waste, fraud, abuse, and mismanagement. And it looks to me like they're on the same track with a project that's going to go off the rails as far as building it here in South Carolina.
Besides the obvious fact that you're building a part of a nuclear bomb, what's wrong with building these things?
My organization, Savannah Riverside Watch, and a couple of others that are in a grouping around the country called Alliance for Nuclear Accountability, a group in New Mexico and a group in California, have been pushing for what's called a programmatic environmental impact statement to take a larger view of what the environmental impacts would be of pursuing this. And National Nuclear Security Administration is absolutely refusing to do that. So we may end up in court here pretty soon. They are conducting, as far as Savannah Riverside goes, an environmental impact statement, but it's not the overarching what's called programmatic environmental impact statement. But there are plutonium waste streams, transuranic waste, low-level waste, chemical waste streams. A lot of that would be dumped at the site. Some of it would go to a facility in New Mexico. DOE has not clarified what all those waste streams are going to be. And for us here in South Carolina, there's already about 12 metric tons of plutonium stored here with unclear plans for disposition. And we don't want them, from an environmental perspective, to get off into this project, bring a lot more plutonium in here, then the whole thing goes belly up and we're stuck with yet more plutonium. So those are some of the environmental type impacts.
Great. Anything you'd like to add?
We are going to pursue a lawsuit if DOE does not agree to do this programmatic environmental impact statement. That decision will be made after February 9th when a so-called record of decision comes out on the whole matter to be published in the Federal Register, so people should stay tuned if we're going to have a big national lawsuit on the plutonium pit production issue.
Tom Clements is the director of Savannah River Site Watch in Columbia, South Carolina. And the Department of Defense said Thursday that 11 American troops were treated for concussions after Iranian missiles struck two Iraqi bases where they were stationed. The January 8th attack on bases near Baghdad and Erbil, Iraq, were launched in retaliation for the killing of Major General Qasem Soleimani. In a speech after the missiles struck, Trump had said, "I'm pleased to inform you the American people should be extremely grateful and happy," adding, "No Americans were harmed in last night's attack by the Iranian regime." The general's death set other events in motion, including the accidental downing of a Ukrainian passenger jet by the Iranian military. 176 people were killed, and the Iraqi parliament called for the expulsion of foreign forces from the country. And in breaking news, U.S. President Donald Trump has warned the supreme leader of Iran to watch his language following a heated sermon in which Ayatollah Ali Khamenei minced no words, slamming American leaders as clowns. Leading a prayer in Tehran on Friday, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei boasted that Iran had the spirit to slap an arrogant, aggressive global power in its retaliation to the assassination of Quds Force Commander Qasem Soleimani, which he said struck a serious blow to Washington's dignity, triggering a response from Trump, who said on Twitter, "The so-called supreme leader of Iran, who has not been so supreme lately, has some nasty things to say about the United States and Europe." Trump tweeted, "Their economy is crashing and their people are suffering. He should be very careful with his words." And Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on Friday broke nearly 72 hours of silence over alleged surveillance and threats to the former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, saying he believed the allegations would prove to be wrong, but that he had an obligation to evaluate and investigate the manner. In interviews with conservative radio hosts, Pompeo said he had no knowledge of the allegations until earlier this week, when congressional Democrats released documents from an associate of President Donald Trump's personal attorney suggesting that Maria Yovanovitch was being watched. He also said he did not know and never met Lev Parnas, the associate of Rudy Giuliani, who made the claim. An attorney and former judge, Bill Blum, has an article in Truthdig on the incident in Iran. It's called Trump's Unprecedented Attack on Iran and the Rule of Law. Blum says it's time to demand an end to Trump's madness once and for all.
Talking about international law, of course, you are talking about a collection of international agreements, international institutions, and customary law, as well as the decisions of international courts, but they're not binding in the same way that the law of the United States, the domestic law, would be binding on the president. Still, the United States purports to abide by international law. And when you talk about the rules of war, you're talking about two different sets of rules. One is the rules that apply before there's a declared war, and then there is the set of rules that applies as to the conduct of a war once declared. We're not in a declared war, and even the administration acknowledges that. And one of the first quotes in my article was from the president himself, who said, "We killed the general in order to avoid a war." So, number one, right off the bat, we know that there's no declaration of war, and so we're not governed by the conduct of an all-out war. So we're governed by those rules that apply to international conflicts short of war. And in that body of international law, what's needed is a showing that the United States was under an imminent threat of attack by this general. And there has been no showing. The Trump administration has utterly failed to do that. And the president, in some of his more recent tweets, has taken the position that it really doesn't matter, that this imminence requirement can be thrown out the window. We're going to take out this general, and I guess anyone else that he deems fit to be taken out, just because he thinks that they have a horrible past, which is how he put it, or to deter them from some anticipated and very vague future threat of an attack on the United States. So this is really a lawless action and an abuse of the president's authority under the Constitution.
Could the president of the United States be impeached for breaking international law?
Well, that's a really great question. You know, John Conyers introduced an article of impeachment against Nixon for the illegal bombing of Cambodia, the secret bombing of Cambodia. But the Judiciary Committee back then didn't pass that particular article of impeachment. And so when it came time to send the articles of impeachment to the floor of the House, that was omitted. So that's never really been done before. And, you know, you hear constantly that impeachment has to be about a clear abuse of power and not over a policy disagreement. I think it's high time that we held our presidents to the letter of the law, and that therefore, an egregious violation of the rules of war and of Congress's power to declare war under Article 1 of the Constitution should be considered an impeachable offense. I think it could be if Congress were only bold enough to do so. But so far, they have not shown themselves to be that.
Isn't it because both the Democrats and Republicans at one time or another were pretty hostile towards Iran?
That's absolutely true. That is unquestionably and undoubtedly true.
As bad as Soleimani was, killing him is this violation of sort of norms of international behavior. And what is, just to wrap up, what is the problem with that?
There are many problems with that. We don't summarily execute people. Think about our domestic law, the law of self-defense. Either you have a right to defend yourself if you're under attack or if there's a reasonable belief that the attack is imminent, that is immediate, not some possible future attack. So we as a people, as a matter of due process, we don't support summary executions, and we shouldn't be doing that as to a foreign state actor.
All right.
Internationally.
Say again?
We shouldn't be doing that internationally either.
Anything you'd like to add?
No, I think that's it.
Great. Very good. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Attorney and former Judge Bill Blum, his article is titled Trump's Unprecedented Attack on Iran and the Rule of Law. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. This week's Democratic presidential debate was overshadowed by the heated dispute between candidates Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders after Warren accused Sanders of telling her a woman couldn't win against Trump this year. But another issue that received much less scrutiny was former Vice President Joe Biden's claim that he opposed the invasion of Iraq, a claim some say was a bald-faced lie. Julie Holler is Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting senior analyst for Election 2020.
What's interesting to us at FAIR about the media coverage of Biden and Iraq is that there is virtually no interest in challenging Biden's presentation of himself as the foreign policy expert, as the serious, steady, mature guy with chops, right? This is how he presents himself on the campaign trail, and this has sort of become the conventional wisdom for the pundits talking about the race. The problem, of course, the big problem here for Biden is his role in the Iraq War. As chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he played a big role in leading the country to war in Iraq. Of course, that is extremely unpopular now. What he's been doing is he's been lying about it. He said that he opposed it from the moment it started, and that he was outspoken about that opposition. And it's just blatantly false. He didn't call the Iraq War a mistake for 3 whole years, when, by the way, people were overwhelmingly against the war at that point. No one called him out on this after that July debate. He starts amping up his lies about his role with the war, and he started saying that he only voted for the war authorization in order to give Bush leverage to get the inspectors back in.
Julie Holler is Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting senior analyst for Election 2020. And in more national news, the House Energy and Commerce Subcommittee on Health held a hearing to examine federal marijuana policy, including the implications of changing its schedule, listing, and potential of cannabis research. 33 states and territories have decriminalized pot for medical purposes, and 11 states and territories have legalized recreational use. The non-high part of pot, called CBDs, have been legalized at the federal level and are widely used, but like pot, little is known to science about the substances. Debbie Dingell represents pot-friendly Ann Arbor, Michigan. She replaced her husband, veteran Representative John Dingell, who died of cancer. She wondered if medical marijuana would have helped ease his suffering.
I want to associate my comments today with everybody at this podium, and I think there's bipartisan frustration on this issue. I think my colleague, Mr. Kennedy, probably summarized where I am very deeply. Michigan is one of the states that is now one of the legal states that this is being traded in. I will be very blunt, I did not support it when it was on the ballot. I come from a family that has seen what drug addiction does to people. But like my colleague, Mr. Griffith, Mr. Schrader, my husband, who many know in this room, suffered from great pain. And many people said that marijuana would be the only thing. Would he try it? And he would not try it. Can you see John Dingell smoking marijuana? Because it was not legal. You did not know the side effects. And it might have given him relief in the end. But I was the keynote speaker at Hash Bash this past year. Yes, you should laugh. It was, my staff told me I couldn't. I don't even know how it got scheduled, if you want to know the truth. But I'm still trying to figure that out.
It wasn't Schedule One.
But I got up and said, I've never smoked marijuana, and don't think I ever will smoke marijuana. But I was getting a lot of indirect smoke that day. But I made the point, I talked to a lot of the scientists, and there were very clearly three things that need to happen, and I am as committed as anybody at this point, the need to get more research on this issue.
And that was Debbie Dingell, representative from Ann Arbor, Michigan. But Nora Volkow, head of the National Institutes of Drug Abuse, says that while more studies are needed for pot and CBDs, she doesn't think the drug has much therapeutic use.
Our understanding of the adverse effects of cannabis is incomplete. This was made clearly evident by the outbreak of e-cigarette or vaping product use associated lung injury, or EVALI, a condition reported in June 2019, predominantly associated with THC vaping, that has over 6 months resulted in more than 2,500 hospitalizations and 55 deaths. Consumption of cannabis edibles, packaged in fruit and drinks, disproportionately account for cannabis-related emergency department visits. Their slow absorption can prompt users to take further doses, resulting in very high THC levels. Toxicity most frequently manifests as acute psychosis, severe anxiety, and cardiovascular complaints. And they also contribute increasingly to intoxication in children.
And one thing to add is that the vaping deaths were eventually associated with vitamin E that was used as an ingredient and not the THC or marijuana that was in the vaping pens. Volkow is a great-granddaughter of Russian revolutionary leader Leon Trotsky. She was raised in Mexico. Her parents were both killed in Stalinist purges right before World War II. She's currently head of the National Institutes of Drug Abuse. Tony Cardenas of Southern California, another representative, a Democrat, says the laws against pot might have more dangerous repercussions to health than marijuana itself.
That for youth in particular, incarceration is tied to poorer physical and mental health outcomes later on in life. Compared to those not incarcerated, children and adolescents in the system for more than a year were 3 times more likely to have functional limitations, over 4 times more likely to have symptoms of depression, and over 2 times more likely to have suicidal effects into adulthood. Now, I'm not talking about the use of cannabis. I'm talking about incarceration. Let me make that clear. Nearly 75% of all of the people arrested for cannabis-related offenses are under the age of 30, and one-fourth are under the age of 18. That's almost a quarter of a million teenagers arrested for these types of offenses each year in the United States of America. I think it's really important for us to understand that calling cannabis a gateway drug in an anecdotal fashion is unfair to the American people, and it's really not the proper dialogue that policymakers and or researchers and or medical experts should be having. And the reason why I say that is because if we're going to have that discussion, we should have the discussion and the question, is alcohol a gateway product or substance? Is nicotine a gateway product or substance? So to think that cannabis is in and of itself a category one and an evildoer to all that touch it is something that should not be the subject of dialogue when it comes to true policymaking and also when it comes to real, honest research.
Tony Cardenas. And that's some of the news for Friday, January 17th, 2020. The news is engineered by Reggie Johnson for the WBAI News. I'm Paul DiRienzo.